Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as the previous speaker, I would like to expand my thanks to you and the organizers of the forum for inviting me. And now I face the challenge of also sticking to 7 minutes. As it has already been mentioned, you know, discrimination, social, economic, and political marginalization of minorities can be a structural precondition or is often also instrumentalized in the lead up to an armed conflict. So there are compelling reasons that we would take into account the a minority rights dimension in conflict prevention strategies. Having said that, I'm actually not going to talk about this anymore for a particular reason. The focus of my intervention is going to be on international humanitarian law, and as some of you may know, international humanitarian law is not concerned with the reason why there is an armed conflict. Instead, it's just it strives to protect persons that are affected by armed conflict, and it seeks to regulate the means and methods of warfare. And quite importantly, international humanitarian law, it's binding on states, but also non-state parties, including armed groups. So I would like to address 3 points. First, I want to talk a bit about the impact of armed conflict on minorities, which has already been addressed by the introduction to this forum. And then more specifically, I want to elaborate a bit on the way how IHL protects minorities. And then third, at the question of how this affects humanitarian relief. So if we look at the impact of armed conflicts in minorities, as it has already been mentioned, we know that armed conflicts generally tend to exacerbate the vulnerability of groups that are already marginalized, or it can deepen or lead to the instrumentalization of divides that already exist. And this is also true when we look at minority groups. Specifically for minority groups, they're often securitized in the sense that either other parties to the conflict may try to co-opt them for their own agenda, or they may be perceived as a threat and dealt with accordingly. As the Special Rapporteur has pointed out in both her report and also in her introductory remarks, actually we have very little data on how armed conflicts impact minorities. But what we know is that it does tend to be a disproportionate impact, that they're often deliberately targeted. In some instances, they're also targeted because they're perceived to be a soft target, less protected by state authorities than the majority group. They're often displaced by virtue of being a minority, and sexual and gender-based violence is frequently employed in a symbolic manner, either to attack the identity of a minority group or as part of a genocidal strategy. So given how armed conflict affects minorities, you may now wonder, well, how does IHL protect minorities? And IHL actually does not protect minorities specifically. It protects minorities through the prohibition of adverse distinction, which is, when we say adverse distinction, what we mean is that you cannot distinguish based on certain prohibited grounds, but in certain circumstances, and depending on the special needs of a particular group, you actually have to treat people differently. So the grounds that are prohibited, they include religion, sex, language, but also political or other opinion, wealth, birth, statutes. And so as you can see, these grounds, they protect minorities because they're included grounds that can often distinguish minorities from others, but they're also broader. They include political opinion, for examples. So the prohibition of adverse distinction does protect minorities, but it's not specifically designed or tailored towards the protection of minorities per se. So it's just, in a way, if you want, so incidental. When preparing for this, then I was quite struck that we say the prohibition of adverse distinction in the treatment of persons is a fundamental underlying principle of all of international humanitarian law. But in reality, it tends to be very much underexplored, both in scholarship and in state practice. And in particular, if we think about the protection of minorities, I think two additional issues would deserve further attention and analysis. The first is that the prohibition of adverse distinction is geared towards the treatment of individuals. And it's very much equivalent in that sense to the human rights law principle of non-discrimination. It's not so clear how the prohibition of adverse distinction could take into account the direct and indirect impact of armed conflict on minority groups and their identity as a minority. So it's not clear how it could look at more collective dimensions. And the second aspect that could be further explored is that when we speak about the prohibition of adverse distinction, we generally look at the treatment of persons who are in the hands of a party to a conflict. So it applies to what we call the protection obligations, such as the provision of medical aid or the guarantee of humane treatment. It's an open question whether the prohibition of adverse distinction may have a broader umbrella function in requiring non-discrimination in the application of all the rules of IHL, including the rules on targeting and the conduct of hostilities more general, which then could play a role in the protection of minorities. The second point, the last point I want to talk about is the prohibition of adverse distinction underlying humanitarian relief. As it has already been mentioned by Professor Gilbert, is that international humanitarian law, it regulates access for humanitarian relief, and it requires that the parties to an armed conflict must allow humanitarian relief for civilians in need, which is impartial in character and conducted without adverse distinction. So if we now think about the accountability of humanitarian actors to deliver such humanitarian relief without adverse distinction, I think first we need to remember that international humanitarian law, it looks at access, but it does not address the accountability of humanitarian actors per se. But if we say that the prohibition of adverse distinction requires the delivery of humanitarian relief to be without adverse distinction, then we could argue that if a state or an armed group would only allow humanitarian relief that is based on such a distinction, that there would be an obligation to refuse the delivery of such relief. And I see that my time is up now, so thank you very much.